commuting in Manila, then you know these sounds for sure. For two decades and counting, the MRT3 has been chugging along its 16.9-kilometer, 13-station route. And it's clearly creaking under the weight of the 300,000 or so commuters who take a ride in it every day. Years of neglect and mismanagement have dented the riding experience to the point that everyone just expects that when you ride the MRT3, you better prepare yourself for long lines and crowded carriages. It's just the way things are in a city with only three railway lines. More than 100 years ago, railways were a bigger part of Manila life. Early in the American period, rails linked the bustling commercial districts of Manila to Pasig, Makati, Taguig, San Juan, Malabon, Marikina, and Muntinlupa. As a Filipino documentary on these railways put it,
"Ang dekada matapos ang digmaang Filipino-Americano."
A decade after the Filipino-American War, Metro Manila had the most extensive network of rails ever laid down in its history.
Riding along most of these rails were streetcars, or as the Spanish call them, tranvias. First set up in 1883 by two enterprising businessmen to run the Tondo to Binondo route, tranvias could be pulled along by teams of 12 to 16 horses. Those had the picturesque name of Tranvía de Sangre, or Tranvías of Blood. But there were also what was called Tranvía de Vapor. Those weren't pulled by horses. Instead, they were propelled by the invention that, all throughout the world, ushered in the Industrial Revolution and the modern age, the steam engine. Welcome to the Colonial Department, the podcast where we take long-lost stories from Philippine colonial history and bring them to life. In this episode, put on your boldest, brassiest steampunk goggles as we delve deep into the Philippines' first steamships, steam engines, and steam-powered trains. This is Season 3, Episode 11, The Dawning of the Age of Steam. The Age of Steam crept up invisibly, inexorably, and very, very slowly on colonial Philippines. The turtly pace of technological development in the archipelago reflected the home country's own plodding modernization. Write Spanish professors Alberto Elena and Javier Ordonez,
"It has been well established that Spain was very slow to embrace modern science and technology, far behind the leading European nations."
It's not that Spanish leaders didn't recognize the need for science and technology, it's just that for 200 years, the Philippine economy ran on the silvery engine of the galleon trade, and there was little incentive to develop other industries or to expand into new markets or to modernize. Elena and Ordonez call this the rentier mentality. If you could import wealth wholesale from your colonies, well, there was little incentive to dabble in doohickeys. But then the 19th century arrived, rising new empires, the collapse of the galleon trade, the tidal wave of independence movements. Spain, like it or not, had to change, and change fast. In the 1830s, a steam-powered dredge was used to scoop out the bottom of a wharf along the south side of the Pasig River. This is the earliest mention that I was able to find of a steam-powered machine operating in the Philippines. If you know of any earlier machine, please message me on my IG account. I'd love to know more. Anyway, Professor Daniel D. Doppers writes about it briefly on page 48 of his award-winning book, Feeding Manila in Peace and War. He gives no other description, but it was likely similar to a machine that was installed along the banks of the Hudson River flowing out of New York. Dredges, which are used to clear out the bottoms of bodies of water, are normally pulled by horses or oxen. In the steam-powered version, however, boilers attached to the great excavator could drag the great buckets along the riverbed with much greater speed and efficiency. Writing in 1832, a U.S. Army engineer said that this steam-powered dredge had the power of about 15 horses and could clear out 50 to 60 cubic yards of mud in 1 hour. If the Pasig River machine was the same or similar to the Hudson River one, it must have also been ridiculously expensive. The Hudson dredge cost $14,000. Repairs set operators back $250 a year. But what I would consider the ground zero for the Philippine steam age was undoubtedly the arrival in 1848 of three steam-powered vessels ordered by the Governor General direct from Britain. After all, these weren't just any ships. These were warships. And they were deployed by Spain for a very specific purpose: to destroy the naval dominance of the Moro slave raiders. Okay, let's not get carried away. If you're thinking of lean, mean machines of war, clad all in iron and belching fearsome, billowing plumes of smoke as the crew furiously shoveled coal into their red-hot furnaces, maybe scale back your imagination a little bit. The Elcano, the Magallanes, and the Reina de Castilla were most likely wooden sailing vessels. Their claim to steam fame, a single expansion engine jammed amidships to run the paddle wheel. The steam engine was probably only fired up when the winds failed to pick up. These kinds of boats were the in-betweens, the missing links, the evolutionary stepping stone from sail to steam. Still, these steamships, and many more like them, were crucial in putting the brakes on the feared Moro slave raids. Striking like lightning across the Philippines' innumerable coasts, there was no seaside town that didn't dread the coming of these marauders from Mindanao. Over the centuries, these raids got so bad that churches had to be built like fortresses. But even the speediest, most rapacious prahus would eventually find themselves outsailed, outpaced, and outmatched by the turbines and pistons of the steam age. Suddenly, sea lanes were safer. The slave raids became a thing of the past. Steam had definitively won out over sail. By 1854, a government steamer was regularly traveling from Manila to Hong Kong to pick up important mail that had been brought in from the motherland. 5 years later, a massive engineering project in the Middle East would knit the colony even closer to global trade. It took slave labor, tens of thousands of deaths, the wholesale creation of two entire cities, and 10 troubled years to finally complete this project. In 1869, the Suez Canal was opened to great fanfare. No longer would ships have to sail all the way down to southern Africa to travel between Asia and Europe. They could instead cut through this great man-made shortcut that sliced clean through the Sinai Peninsula so that ships could cross to the Red Sea as easily as Moses parting the waters. From then on, steamships became a more common sight in Philippine waters. If before, it took anywhere from 3 to 6 months to travel to Europe, now you could get there in just a month. Spain also began subsidizing domestic shipping in the colony. By 1881, a little Philippine steamer called the Camiguin was making regular rice runs from Manila to Dagupan. Natives called the steamboats vapores. From steamships, let's now move on to steam-powered trains. But before we shift over to the train talk, let's talk a little about how commerce was conducted into and out of Manila. Before the industrial age, how were trade goods transported? Basically, it was through boats, writes Daniel Doppers.
Cascos were the workhorse vessels that delivered most of the freight. These were long, flat-bottomed watercraft propelled by poling and sometimes by sail. Cargoes included rice, firewood, palm vinegar, freshly cut sugar cane, semi-processed sugar, even watermelons. Almost anything of value and bulk that was not immediately perishable.
These boats sailed down the currents of the rivers, the creeks, the streams, the canals, all the vital veins and arteries that kept the heart of Manila beating. Because of their geography, two important trading centers emerged in Luzon. Malabon was a swampy lowland that was the natural endpoint of many waterways, and so it became a major stopover for farmers and fishermen and merchants who wanted to sell crops and foodstuffs to the capital city. If you've ever wondered why Malabon has a reputation for having great cuisine, its history as a great food marketplace is the reason why. Further up north was another important trading center, Dagupan. It became popular for the same reason Malabon did. Boats from the great farming regions of Central Luzon could paddle their way there, and even small trading vessels could pull up to the enormous Dagupan wharf and load up on rice and other necessities. By 1881, or by the time the little steamer coming in was doing its rounds, Dagupan provided a whopping 78.9% of Manila's rice supplies. So it made sense that when the first Philippine Railway was being planned, Dagupan would be the city that it would link up to. The Spanish didn't build the first train line in the colony. Instead, it was built largely with British capital and set up in segments beginning 1891, connecting Manila to central Pangasinan, northern Tarlac, and lower Pampanga and Bulacan, before finally ending up at the busy Dagupan wharves through a small spur in its northernmost terminal. The line was fully completed in November 1892, but there was a problem. There was a big break in the tracks because of the Pampanga River. Cargo and passengers had to take boats across to ride the train on the other side. It took almost 2 years for the last major bridge to be completed so that you can ride uninterrupted all the way from Tutuban Station in Manila to the Dagupan Terminal. Like a long and winding magnet, the railway tracks also attracted even more industrialists. By 1891, large, steam-powered rice mills were grinding and clanking and chugging along beside the railway. Just like the trains, they were run by foreign capital. The steam-powered machines, too, were imported from abroad. As Daniel Doppers writes,
"In late 19th century Manila, newspapers was a steady stream of ads for iron milling machinery, steam engines, pumps, and plows. Most of the advertised manufacturers were British, the initial world leader in this technology."
And so we return to the Tranvía. Older than the Dagupan Railroad by a decade, among the first streetcars were four steam-powered Tranvía de Vapor, whose engines were made in Germany and carried passengers from Manila to the very important trading center of Malabon. The growing Tranvía network was soon complemented by horse-drawn streetcars. When the Americans came and bought the Philippines from Spain, a new company took over the operation of the Tranvía and began converting many of them into electric streetcars. This company still exists today. In fact, if you live in or near Manila, they're probably sending you a bill right this very second. Yes, that's right. That company is Meralco. The time of the Americans also introduced a brand new technological innovation that would also change the world, the automobile. Despite the expanding network of railways the Americans had set up, priorities and public tastes shifted to cars and trucks. The government obliged, prioritizing highways over railways. Now, almost a century and a half after the first railway tracks were laid in the Philippines, you only need to glance out your window at the traffic-choked streets of Manila to realize that in the end, it was the car that won out over the train. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Colonial Department. References used in this episode are written on the show notes, but I'd also like to express my thanks to my main sources. 1. Alberto Elena and Javier Ordóñez's article, Science, Technology, and the Spanish Colonial Experience in the 19th Century. 2. Daniel Doppers' book, Feeding Manila in Peace and War, 1850-1945. 3. TVUP's documentary, Tranvía, ang mga riles sa kamay nilaan. And finally, Benito Legarda's influential text, After the Galleons, Foreign Trade, Economic Change, and Entrepreneurship in the 19th Century Philippines. Quotes from sources were read by Anya Ong. MRT3 recording by M.M. De Mesa. The Colonial Department was written and produced by Leo Mangubat. Follow us on Instagram @thecolonialdepartment.